Hey, it's your friend Mel, and welcome to the Mel Robbins Podcast. So just this morning, literally a couple hours ago, before I walked into the studio, sat down in this chair, and am talking to you now, I get this text from one of my close college friends, and it said, Mel, I really need some help. Do you have 5 minutes? And she was texting me because she was looking for recommendations on what to do because her daughter's anxiety, it is through the roof. And you know what? I'm not surprised because I'm seeing so many people in my life. I'm seeing so many emails coming into the inbox at melrobbins.com, comments, DMs about this exact same topic. And the thing that was kind of crazy about today is that she texts me this question about anxiety, looking for resources. Where do I start? How do I help this person I care about? And do you know what you and I are talking about? Literally in a matter of a minute, we are sitting down with one of the world's leading anxiety experts from Harvard University. He's the founder of the Center for Anxiety. I mean, what are the odds? Don't you just love it when life confirms the very thing you're about to do? It's like a little sign. Okay, you're on the right track. Just keep going. And as somebody who struggled with anxiety for decades and who has had kids who have struggled with anxiety, here's what I know. It can be so scary when it's happening to you or to somebody that you love. But I also want you to know something. You have within you the capacity to face whatever is scaring you. And this conversation needs to happen right now. And I'm so glad that you are here for it because Dr. David Rosmarin is about to flip everything that you and I know on its head about anxiety. This is going to be a resource, a place for you to start. If you or somebody that you love is struggling with this anxiety, and by the end of this episode, you're going to know exactly what anxiety is and what it isn't. You're going to understand the things that you're probably doing that are making it worse for you or the person that you care about. You're going to have a whole new way to look at this and a four-step approach that's going to work. And this is exactly what you need to help somebody who's struggling with anxiety. And the good news is Dr. Rosmarin says, if you feel trapped by anxiety or you've been trying to outrun it or outdrink it or outsleep it or whatever, what he's about to share with you will set you free. Hey, it's your friend Mel, and welcome to the Mel Robbins Podcast. I am so thrilled that you're here. I am excited for today's conversation. I love talking and learning about ways that you can understand anxiety and help somebody who is kind of struggling with it right now, and that's what we're going to do. It is always such an honor to spend time with you and to be together. And I want to take a minute and acknowledge that if you're a new listener, welcome. Welcome to the Mel Robbins Podcast family. I'm so thrilled that you hit play and that you made time to listen to this particular episode because I know that you don't have a lot of time. I know you value your time. And I know that you're listening because either you struggle with anxiety or you're feeling a little bit more anxious than normal, or you know somebody who does, and you're looking for resources that are going to help you get control of your anxiety or support someone else. And I'm going to tell you something. You're going to want to share this with everybody that you care about. Because this is a life-saving and a priceless resource with one of the most respected and renowned experts on the planet practicing medicine today, working with thousands of patients around the world who are struggling with anxiety. And if you're here listening to this right now because somebody shared this with you, I want to tell you that's amazing because it tells me that you have people in your life who care about you. And this episode is going to remind you, no matter what you're facing, no matter how you're feeling, no matter how much your thoughts are spiraling, or you're kind of getting into that grip where you're just so worried that bad things are going to happen at work or in your relationship or to somebody you care about, I want you to know you're not alone and you're definitely not powerless. And this doesn't have to be your life and it's not going to last. There are things you can do and you're about to learn from the world's leading expert over at Harvard what you can do about anxiety. This is your resource. This is your starting point. And I want you to know, I know exactly what you're feeling because I did struggle with anxiety for decades and I spent years running away from it. When things got too difficult to bear, you know what I'd do? I'd try to wash those anxious feelings away with a drink, or I'd lie in bed and just pull the covers over my head and wish that things would go away if I just stayed in bed. Or my favorite thing to do? Oh, just stay busy. Stay so busy you don't have time to think about anything. Is this sounding familiar? I'm sure it is. Because we all try to outrun the bad feelings. We all don't want to face the thing that we're scared to face. And see, that's the thing about anxiety. It doesn't feel good, does it? And it also doesn't feel good to watch somebody that you care about struggle with it. Whatever it is that you are trying to do to forget the feeling or to get rid of it or deny that it's even there. I mean, why wouldn't you? Who would blame you if you did want to get rid of your anxiety? I mean, I don't blame you. Well, what if there's another way? What if there's an entirely different way to think about the topic of anxiety, an entirely different way to respond when you start to feel a little anxious? What if there's a different way to show up for the people in your life when they start feeling anxious? What if instead of running away, you actually learned how to run toward it? I mean, what does that even mean? Well, our expert today is going to tell you exactly what it means. Dr. David Rosmarin is one of the world's leading experts on anxiety. He's the founder of the Center for Anxiety, which offers therapy across the United States. And it's focused on not just living with, but thriving with anxiety. And when I heard that, I was like, okay, thriving? I'm a little skeptical. Well, I think Dr. Rosmarin is going to suspend all disbelief and set us free. He's an associate professor of psychology at Harvard Medical School and the director of the Spirituality and Mental Health Program at McLean Hospital, which is one of the top-ranked psychiatric hospitals on the planet. He is also the author of Thriving with Anxiety, 9 Tools to Make Your Anxiety Work for You. And he'll be the first to tell you, he deals with anxiety too. And after 15 years as a leader in this field, he has learned something that you will probably find kind of surprising. Embracing that dreaded anxiety, it's actually good for you. It can actually enrich your life, make you happier, more confident, more resilient person. Now, that may sound like a very tall order, especially if you can't sleep because your anxiety is so bad or you don't know what it feels like to not have racing thoughts, but there is a different way to live. So if you and I are going to trust anyone, how about we promise each other that we're not going to trust the negative thoughts right now? We're going to trust Dr. Rosmarin because he says he can show you anxiety is not the curse you think it is. And he's actually going to teach you today how you can start seeing it as a blessing you can embrace. Now, there's a word I never thought I'd use before today's conversation. So let's just jump in. Dr. David Rosmarin, I am so excited that you're here.
I am even more excited.
Well, one of the reasons why I'm excited is because I am asked the question over and over and over again. For some reason right now, this is one of the biggest things I've been asked, which is I either have somebody that I love that's struggling with anxiety or I am suddenly very anxious. Where do I even start? And I feel like this conversation and the honor of being able to sit down with you and learn from you in the way that you are counseling and helping and healing people around the world with your work who are struggling with anxiety. I just feel like this is going to be the biggest gift. And so I would love for you to tell the person listening who has made the time to learn from you today, what could change about their life or the person's life that they're going to share this with if they take everything to heart that you're about to share with us based on all of your experience and they use it in their life?
There are two things.
Okay.
The most fundamental is to stop judging yourself for feeling anxious, to stop feeling anxious about the fact that you have anxiety in your life, because everyone does. It's a normal human emotion. In fact, if you don't have anxiety, something's probably wrong. That's number one. And number two, once you accept that it's part of your life, you can use it as an ally instead of an enemy.
That's a pretty tall promise, the ally versus an enemy, because I think anybody who is struggling with anxiety or watching somebody struggle with it, it does seem like an enemy.
It sure does.
And that's why I was really curious, because the title of your best-selling book is Thriving with Anxiety. Because when I hear thriving with anxiety, it almost presumes that I got to keep it. And I'm like, but doc... I want to thrive without this stuff.
Of
so
course.
What is possible when you say you can make it an ally or you can thrive?
I would say it's almost as counterintuitive as let them.
What do you mean?
Well, I don't want to let them. I want to control them. I want to stop them. these annoying, irritating situations in my life. Once you accept that you can't, that actually becomes a resource for you to become more resilient, more connected to people who are worth connecting to, worth focusing more on things in your life that you can control. And anxiety is the same way. It's kind of like let them for your internal world.
So meaning that because we don't understand what anxiety actually is and because we're afraid of it, actually, it reminds me of a passage in your book that I want to read to you that I found so interesting. Okay. Anxiety is nothing to fear in and of itself. This is page 35 I'm reading from. My office has serviced over 10,000 patients.
Correct.
And we have never had a patient die from anxiety. No one has ever been hurt from their anxiety symptoms or, quote, gone crazy from the acute experience of anxiety, even though I'll add that you often feel like you're going crazy.
Sure.
And you write, yes, people can develop behavioral problems in the context of anxiety, including alcohol or substance misuse, self-injury, and suicidality. However, if you want your anxiety to decrease, the last thing you want is to flood your system with more adrenaline. So reacting with catastrophic or self-judgmental thoughts to the fear response only makes it worse. And so what I take from just that passage is that we kind of have anxiety all wrong. And because we do, we're making it worse.
100%. That's exactly what's happening. Our society is over-medicalizing, over-pathologizing a normal human emotion. Now, don't get me wrong. At a certain point, it does become pathological, but we are conflating clinical pathological anxiety with normal anxiety that all healthy human beings experience. And in making all of that one big lump of craziness, we have become allergic to the normal side of anxiety. And that's creating the anxiety epidemic today.
Wow. So will you unpack that allergic part? Because you also write about that in your book, that anxiety is almost like an allergy. So you just said something that I think needs to be said even louder, which is there's a massive difference between the kind of chronic, crushing anxiety that becomes a massive debilitating problem in somebody's life and the very normal anxiety that absolutely every human being is going to feel. And if you understand it, it doesn't have to get worse. It can be something that can actually be an ally that you're not afraid of. What do you mean when you said allergy, though?
I did this for years myself. I would show up to work, have clammy hands, have a little bit of an upset stomach. My breathing would be a little bit labored because it's a stressful day. And I would say, David, what's wrong with you? Until it was really during the COVID pandemic that it hit me. I'm like, that's not true. Like, we're going through a hard time. We're going to feel somewhat anxious. In fact, if I didn't feel anxious, then something would be wrong. And then I realized we need to bifurcate between normal anxiety, which is actually potentially a very great resource to thrive in your life, and then clinical anxiety, which does need professional treatment, whether it's medication or psychotherapy or something more sophisticated and targeted. But we're getting it wrong, and it's having disastrous consequences, especially for kids.
How does being nervous or feeling on edge, how is that an example of thriving when you're facing something challenging?
Well, it does depend what you do with it.
Okay.
If we take those nerves, those regular healthy anxiety feelings, sensations, thoughts that are going through, and we actually get to the bottom of it, we probe, we think about what's making us anxious, we can become more self-aware, right?
Yeah.
If we share it with someone else, we can broaden and deepen our connections with other people and become more intimately related to them.
Yeah.
And if we embrace it, well, we can actually build our emotional fortitude to be able to face adversity. And we can also even use it to let go. And I think that's the process that we have to start using with normal, healthy aspects of anxiety, as opposed to get rid of it. And our immediate knee-jerk reaction is get rid of these feelings. Something is wrong with me. I shouldn't be feeling this way. And immediately your adrenaline is going to spike because you're interpreting the lower levels of anxiety as a problem. So that's literally going to create a physiological cascade. And it dumps more adrenaline into your system.
It makes so much sense. And yet when you're in that spiral or that panic about your job or the interview or whether or not you're going to meet quota or if the person that you're seeing is falling out of love with you, you don't have access to that ability, or at least not now. That's what you're going to teach us how to do. To catch, is this sadness or depression? And I guess I would put in that, is this normal nerves?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this actually something to be worried about as a state?
It's exactly the first question to ask.
And it's something I've never done, is stop myself in those moments where I'm starting to go up in my head and ruminate and panic and think about all the worst things that could happen, which only freaks me out more. And I've seen my kids do the same thing. And then I avoid the thing that I need to do, which only makes me feel more doubtful and affirm that I can't handle it. And so I could see how the first thing would be, whoa, 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 whoa. Is this a normal set of nerves based on what's going on and a sign that I'm actually mentally well, or is this something way bigger?
Correct.
Could you just explain to the person listening how exactly you found yourself in this work and starting the Centers for Anxiety? Like, what led you here?
Sure. Looking back in the last 20 years, I would probably, if I had to be honest, it's going to be my own anxiety. And this has very much been a personal journey for me. I was taught in graduate school, I was taught in my training to diagnose, treat, help people to get rid of their clinical anxiety. Mm-hmm. And those tools are still something that I use on a daily basis in a variety of different, you know, contexts in my work. But, you know, it took going through the pandemic to actually click into this concept that not all forms of anxiety are problematic and bad. And we can potentially even use those lower levels of anxiety in a constructive, positive, healthy way to help us to thrive and to grow in our lives.
Well, I mean, I'll just admit right away, you know, having struggled with anxiety for almost 30 years, you know, I'll take full responsibility for the fact that I was afraid of anxiety. I hated it. I ran from it. I tried to drink it away. I tried to outwork it.
Yep.
And none of it worked. And some of the medications worked to mute it, and they were life-saving ladders to help me climb out of a hole. But not understanding what you're talking about already, and so I want to take a giant highlighter and say there's a huge difference between low-level anxiety that is normal and the higher-level debilitating anxiety that is the focus of your clinical practice.
Correct.
We're going to get into the tools that you can use for yourself and you can also use with people in your life that are feeling anxious, but I should probably just back up and start with some of the basics.
Sure.
What is your definition of anxiety, Dr. Ross Marin?
Okay. There are cognitive aspects, things that are going on in your mind. There are physiological or emotional aspects, and then there are behavioral aspects, usually avoidance, but maybe some checking. So let's go through them. The cognitive aspects, worry, apprehension, you're nervous something's going to happen, focusing on the negative thoughts spinning in your head. If I go to this event, somebody will judge me. People won't, you know, I will have a panic attack. I'm not going to feel good. I'm not going to be able to manage it.
If I don't do well in this sales meeting, I'm going to get fired.
Sure.
Yeah. If I don't wear the right thing on this date, they're not going to like me.
At best, maybe even worse. Never have another date again, right? This is my only opportunity.
I'll be alone forever. Best. The thoughts are way worse. I'm never going to find anyone. I'm going to always be the single for blah, 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 blah. Okay,
sure,
gotcha.
Sure. And then there's the physiological. So that's something, you know, the sweaty palms, the upset stomach, labored breathing. And that's really adrenaline, which is going through one system, and it creates those cotton mouth. It creates these symptoms that people have and the feeling associated with that foreboding, you know, those kinds of emotions that go along with it. That's the constellation.
That's the constellation. Why does this happen? So why does this happen before a test? Why does this happen before a date? Why does this happen if you have a stressful day at work? Why does this happen if you have to see your in-laws and you don't particularly enjoy them?
Sure. Why do babies, right when they're born, let out this massive scream?
Is it because they're getting air in their lungs for the first time?
Yeah, and it's kind of new and scary, and like they've been in this comfortable little bubble for however many months, and they're in this, all of a sudden, this different environment, and there's lights, and there's people, and there's breathing, like you mentioned,
right.
And there's a digestion change, and heart changes, and all sorts of stuff all at once, and a healthy child will go, and freak out. And if they don't freak out, what do we say?
Uh-oh.
Exactly. You call in a neurologist. Those kids usually don't survive.
So what's happening in my body if I'm going into work on a stressful day and I feel anxious? Like, how is that the same as a baby crying?
You're a healthy person. On a stressful day at work, if you're not having a little bit of your hands aren't a little bit clammy and you're not feeling a little bit jazzed up. Like, you don't recognize that there's a task for you to do. There's something important. You're maybe disconnected from the meaning of your work. You might be disconnected from the relationship you have with your peers. That doesn't sound like a good work colleague. Having a little bit of apprehension and anxiety and nervousness walking into those situations shows that you care.
That's a beautiful reframe. And I think for those of us that are feeling it, or we see this present in our children or our partner or a colleague, what is the thing you could say in that moment? Because I think it's those micro moments that we really screw up.
Totally.
And so what do you do in that moment?
I love your specific example of parents and children. Little Jimmy or Jenny comes home. They feel a little bit anxious. And the parent themselves is a little anxious themselves. And they are freaked out about the fact that their kid is feeling anxious. So what do? Try to put out the fire. They try to calm them down. They try to say everything's going to be okay. They give them reassurance. Say, you don't have to go to school. Don't worry. You don't have to go to that event. We accommodate them. As opposed to, oh, you're feeling anxious. That sounds interesting. Tell me more. With no judgment, and just to explore it and actually create a more deep connection between parent and child. Ask questions. What is little Jimmy or Jenny afraid of and why? Is it embarrassment? Are they afraid of messing up and being overly responsible? Are they afraid of the physical sensations? Do they feel like a failure? Are they afraid of losing friends? Ask them lots of questions. And without trying to change it, don't try to change how they're thinking, how they're feeling, their behavior in any way. Just be there with them while they feel anxious. They just want you to connect with them. Turn it into a point of connection as opposed to a moment of education. We are missing this fundamental perspective on anxiety, and it's having disastrous consequences for those micro moments. We judge others, we judge ourselves for feeling anxious, and we go down the tubes in a hot second because of it.
So even just stopping yourself from joining in, and that's terrible, and you got to calm down, and I'm going to call the school, and you don't need to do this.
Definitely don't do
that. You're just actually making it worse. Because why?
Because you're conveying a message. I wouldn't even say it's subliminal or subconscious. It's direct. You are directly showing your child something is wrong here, and they become afraid of their anxiety as a result.
So what's the mistake that the person who is listening right now might be making when they're dealing with their own anxiety in life?
Misinterpreting it as a problem that or a weakness or a disease or that something is wrong with you, as opposed to this is a normal human emotion. And then once we accept that, what do I do with it?
So we're going to go into your four-step process that you use in your clinical practice. Can you just tell it to us at a top level?
Sure. The four steps are as follows: identify, share, embrace, and let go. I'll explain each one. Identify means getting to the root. What are you truly afraid of? Instead of putting it out of your mind, instead of squelching the symptoms, go there. Think about it. Get to what's actually bothering you. Two, share. Talk about it with someone else. Open up about it. Make it a point of connection as opposed to sitting in a state of loneliness. Three, embrace. Your favorite. Do that which makes you feel anxious. When you're ready and at a rate that you're comfortable with, but that is the path for emotional resilience. And finally, let go. There are certain things we can't control. Anxiety is always surrounded around control. And at a certain point, we need to let go. To the extent that you can do that, you've completed the four steps.
It seems so simple, which is probably why it works so well. Let's take a kid who has trouble doing a sleepover, which is a very normal thing.
Very
common. Even bigger one.
Sure.
A kid who is anxious about throwing up.
Happens every day.
Well, and my son, even to this day, at the age of 19, okay. Oakley will allow me to share this, is afraid of throwing up. Even though he has thrown up and knows that he can throw up, he still will get anxious about throwing up. And it was a huge thing when he was a kid.
Yep. So if he were here, I would want to know what's the focus of his apprehension. That's a very fancy way of saying what's at the root of his anxiety. Can we identify what is he really afraid of? When you vomit, it's unpleasant. Is it taste? Is it embarrassing yourself? Is it some sort of just the gag reflex and you just don't like how it feels? But if so, I'd want to know what about it. Did he watch a video once and there's an association with that video? I would have a whole bunch of questions here to ask with no judgment, simply to explore what about that situation is so upsetting for him.
You know what I love about this?
What?
Is that I so screwed this up because I'd be like, you're not going to get sick. You're going to be fine. It'll happen. There's a nurse at school. Mm-hmm. Get on the bus. And what you're doing is you're actually slowing down that micro moment and you're going deeper and saying, well, what would happen and what is it really? And when you get to that answer, let's just say it's that I just hate the taste and I hate the pressure on my face.
Yep.
And I hate it that it's going to happen and you're not there, or that somebody's going to see
it.
Hold
on. If it's going to happen and you're not there is important. What about vomiting without mom is upsetting? I'd want to know that. Based on what they say, I'm going to probe a little bit further and get like, what about that specifically is going to be upsetting to you?
You know, I heard our pediatrician share with me that the fear of throwing up is one of the biggest fears that kids have behind their parents dying. And when you hear kids talk about this in your practice, like what typically is underneath some of these very common things that cause kids anxiety, whether it's sleepovers or it's separation anxiety or it's throwing up.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, I often think it is about the throwing up. There's an association because like the kid threw up at some point and one of the parents cleaned it up and it was not pleasant for anyone.
Oh, so we shamed them.
Well, there is a bit of a fear of that. I'm not saying that you did. By the way, the therapist in me really wants to probe for your like sort of over-responsibility for your kid's anxiety. I'm totally sort of dying to do that, but I don't want to turn this into a therapy session. So we'll stay on topic. With regards to whatever it is though, you want to probe and really get down to the sort of the root of it. And I think this is something we can do ourselves.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
I'm going to feel ashamed if I throw up. It's embarrassing. Someone else is going to have to clean it up. And if it's someone else's house and I'm doing a sleepover, it's like someone else's mom and dad. Like, ugh, that's a valid fear.
Yeah. And I also feel like, you know, I've heard this definition recently around anxiety that made so much sense to me. And I'd love to hear your reaction. And then I want to get into more examples about the things that you're seeing in your practice with your patients to just normalize the types of not only fears and anxious feelings that people have, but the way they rationalize the stuff in their head.
Sure.
And then hold themselves back because of it. And it's this, that anxiety is really a moment of uncertainty in life.
Yes.
And you doubt your capacity to handle it.
That's exactly correct.
And because we then start worrying about how things are going to be, I'm going to throw up, or the work's going to be terrible, or I'm going to get fired, or this person's never going to love me, or I'm never going to meet anybody again, or if I park in a parking garage on the top floor, then the car is going to roll off and fall to its face, and I'm going to like that.
Could happen.
Right? It could.
Could happen.
Probably not, but it could happen, right? Yeah, those things could happen. It's the fact that you doubt your ability to handle it that gets you trapped in your mind going over all of the what ifs.
Well, that's where the next two steps are.
So let's go to the second step.
The second step is sharing.
Okay.
Sharing your emotions, the core of it, with someone else can create connection with someone. Now, you have to share with purpose, right? And there's not everyone in all circumstances can you share with them. If you're sharing with a stressed out loved one who's coming back after a really, you know, nasty business trip, or really they're going through a hard time themselves, they might not be able to hear it right now. But sharing it in a certain context and being clear, I need you to validate me. I just need you to hear me out. I'm feeling anxious. I want you to be here and present with me.
Mm-hmm.
And then sharing it can create more intimacy and connection between parents and children, certainly between loved ones, between friends. I've even seen it happen with strangers where people open up to each other and like, hey, I feel that way too. Like instant connection.
Or on a plane. A friend of ours flew in here, a colleague, and had horrendous turbulence, which by the way, if I'm taking what you're teaching us, Dr. Russ Maron, if you're anxious on a plane that is like riding a bucking bronco.
Yep.
It's a sign that you're mentally well and that your body's working as it should.
Yeah. What's wrong with you if you're not feeling anxious?
Correct. And he said the woman next to him started hyperventilating. So he held her hand
there
and told her, I'm nervous too, but we're going to be okay. And look at the attendants. They're chatting away. We're going to be okay. And so her sharing with him that she felt that way created a complete connection with the stranger.
She will never forget him.
That's true.
Ever.
That's true. What's the third step after you tell somebody?
Once we share and we're connected to people, embrace the anxiety. This
now,
is where we
how the hell do I do that?
Face it. Do something that makes you anxious.
I don't want to.
I know, but you also don't want to go to the gym to build your physical muscles, but you do that.
That's true.
Why doesn't it, every school in the United States of America have mental, like a mental, emotional agility, resilience building by doing something that makes you feel a little bit uncomfortable? As long as it's safe and it's something that you want to do, do it.
Dr. Ross Marin, I have a lot more questions that I want to ask you about this, but I want to take a quick pause. Let's let all of this information settle in. And while you listen to a word from our sponsors, share this with somebody that you love. I mean, this is world-class medical research-backed advice. Everybody in your life deals with anxiety, and everybody deserves to know how they can thrive when those moments hit. So don't go anywhere, because Dr. Ross Marin and I are going to be waiting for you after a short break. So stay with me. Welcome back. It's your buddy Mel Robbins. And today you and I are learning from world-renowned expert on anxiety, Dr. Ross Marin. So if you're going to embrace your anxiety, and that's the answer, which I don't like to hear, I'm just going to say right out, like, if I am a person, we all have this person in our life whose identity has become anxiety. Okay. And it is also the thing that they say to opt out. And I have been that person. And so if embracing anxiety, after you've identified what am I really scared of, you share it. Now we got to embrace the thing you're actually scared of, that root thing, right?
Correct.
How do you do that? Can you share examples?
Sure. There's this brilliant approach called the 5-second rule.
Oh, no. Do not turn my work back on
me. Am I wrong? That's
no.
What it is. I'm getting out of bed even though I feel like hell right now. I'm going to do this. I don't want to, you know, I've had people with a fear of snakes.
Okay.
I literally have a guy on speed dial who I can, should I bring him in?
No, not right now.
That's fine. You're not ready for
it. So how do you coach somebody through this? Because you do have a section in your book where you on, let's see here. I marked it actually. It's page 96, facing up to anxiety.
Exposure therapy. Yeah. Chapter 3.
Is exposure therapy the only answer?
It's not the only answer. It's a very, very good tool. And when you have clinical anxiety, it has to be part of the picture. If you're not going to face your anxiety eventually, it's going to be hard to get over it. But I think it's one step. I think we do have to identify it. We do have to share it.
Right.
We do have to embrace it. I think there's something beyond it. But let's focus on exposure therapy for now.
Okay. So you're afraid of flying?
You're going to fly at some point when you're ready. We're going to take, by the way, are you more nervous about short hauls or long hauls?
Me?
No, just let's make it up.
Oh, got it. Probably smaller planes.
Smaller planes. Great. Perfect. So there's an airline that goes out of Boston Logan called Cape Air. Okay.
It's got like 7 seats.
I think it's 8. And one of them is actually in the cockpit. And I've been in it. It's a Cessna plane. It's basically a minivan with wings.
Dr. Russ Martin, I would quit as your patient. Like, do you actually get people to do this?
Sure. I was going to say it's a lot of fun, but not only is it fun for me, it's fun for them at a certain point because they are embracing their anxiety and saying, I can do this. I'm not going to let it get in my way.
What about shyness?
Great. Harder to target, tends to be longer term, tends to be focused, also comorbid with depression. People get a lot more depressed because if you're shy, you're more disconnected from others, more isolated, more alone, more sad. So often building that person up first is important clinically through more identification and a lot more sharing, not just with a therapist, but also with other people in their world, sometimes posting on social media, whatever it is. But at a certain point, they're going to have to go to the party and not have a martini.
Why no martini?
Because the martini is an anxiolytic.
That's a big word. What does that
big
mean?
Big word for saying it reduces your anxiety.
Temporarily. Then you wake up in the morning with a massive hangover and anxiety is the big symptom.
And then you're ruminating about all the stuff that you said that you shouldn't have said because you're a little bit tipsy.
What about for OCD? Like somebody who's like worried about like cleanliness and germs.
Great. So let's just say these hands have been in many places that I will not tell you about.
Today?
Not today. Not today. Don't worry. And I do wash my hands before I eat. But before washing my hands and before eating, you'd be surprised where these go. But part of being an anxiety therapist means you have to do everything that your patients do also.
So what do you do with those like really dirty, grimy hands?
Okay, so I'm thinking of a specific patient who came in who was terrified of germs. and for many years had been avoiding all sorts of situations. Really wouldn't open car doors, certainly wouldn't ride the subway, was at one point putting gloves on their hands, lots of Purell, lots of excessive washing, had actually had very significant chafing, even needed some medical treatments in order to be able to deal with, you know, abrasions on their hands from all the washing. And really, we started with touching things that would make them feel uncomfortable. Started with things in the office. It could have been as simple as this desk surface. It could have been things that, you know, in the bathroom would be next. And eventually moving towards the inside of a toilet bowl or things that are way over the top that you wouldn't normally do in order for them to develop the resilience to stand up to their anxiety head on.
The toilet. Oh. So how does somebody get through the uncomfortable feelings that they have while they're doing this exposure therapy with you?
The first step is always the same, which is, do you want to do this? Once somebody wants to face their anxiety and build their resilience by deliberately putting themselves in an anxiety-provoking situation, like once you catch the bug, like once you want to do it, there's nothing that'll stop you.
What if when they first start doing it, they feel so uncomfortable or the anxiety just spikes and they're like, I can't do this. I can't do this. I can't get on that plane. I can't put my hands on the toilet. I can't put my hands on the table. What do you do?
So we prep people beforehand. They will think, I can't do this. I'm not going to be able to handle this. My anxiety is going to spike. I'm going to get sick. All of those thoughts are going to be rocketing through your head because that's what facing anxiety entails. That's part of the process. And that is exactly why it's an opportunity to build emotional resilience.
How many times, Dr. Ross Marin, does it take for somebody to start feeling less anxious when they start forcing themselves to do this thing, you know, expose themselves to the thing that they're terrified to do?
Often we see a significant drop in anxiety even after once or twice from doing it, but sometimes it does require many, many more repetitions. In some ways, it depends on how long they've been avoiding situations. If people have been avoiding germs and microbes and all sorts of things for decades, it might take a while for them to get through it. But it's kind of like a mortgage, like eventually you pay it off.
What about a parent who has a child who is starting to develop a pattern
Yes.
of not wanting to either go to school or participate in sports or who won't do sleepovers? And Yeah. it's with a family that's safe. It's not some creepy family you don't know and they don't want to do it because Right. they don't want to be there. What about then?
We can't, when we push kids to do things that they don't want to do, there's a balance. And helping scaffold to kids that they want to do it, selling them on it, so to speak, onboarding, we talk about onboarding kids, onboarding teens. Once somebody recognizes this will help build my resilience, this will help make me a stronger emotional person, then they're like, okay, I'm in. And at a certain point with planes, you might be there too. Like, you know what? I want to do this. I don't want this to get in my way in any way. I want to be more fearless
Yeah.
in my life. I want to, just like you want to learn how to pump iron or be able to run a marathon or run at a certain time pace or whatever it is. We all have our fitness goals. And I think we should also have our emotional goals. We don't have that.
Well, one of the things that I love that you said at the very beginning of our conversation, when you made this life-altering distinction.
Thank you.
Now, for real, sadness is a normal emotion that you're going to feel. And you know it comes and it goes.
Yep.
Depression is a clinical condition that interferes with your life that demands and deserves treatment.
Correct.
Anxiety, in terms of chronic anxiety or this fear that you have of things that keeps you from living your full life, is very different than being nervous or on edge because the stakes are high mm-hmm. or something's uncertain or you really care about doing well. Like, you know, I would imagine there's a tremendous amount of anxiety that you would feel before you take the LSAT or before
Sure.
you are turning in a college application or
going on a first date.
Going on a first date. And that's, again, in this range of nervousness and just uncertainty, which is a part of life. And what you taught us is in those moments, we literally do the wrong thing.
Correct.
We either go, uh-oh, this is a sign something's about to go wrong. And it's not. It's just a sign that you're about to do something where you doubt your ability for a bit. And then as the bystander, the friend, the boyfriend, the girlfriend, the husband, the wife, the parent, the grandparent, we literally are either like, oh, you're going to do fine. So we don't acknowledge it.
Right.
or we join in with the anxiety.
Oh my God, something's wrong.
Yes.
Yes.
Oh, you don't have to go to the sleepover. Oh, you don't have to try out for that team.
Right.
You know, you can take the test again if you screw it up. And I can see how powerful it is to catch these moments and reaffirm, oh, really? That makes sense that you'd be nervous. Tell me why exactly are you nervous about this test that's coming up? Or I can see why you'd be nervous. Like, tell me more about this date you're going on. What does that do for a person in the moment?
It takes so much of the edge off, as opposed to giving me more of a reason to be anxious about my anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
It normalizes and makes it so much more manageable. It's just a different framework. It's kind of like having glasses that are like a different color. It just changes the whole view of everything around you. And by the way, it's not just the parents and the teachers. It actually comes from the medical profession. Something crazy happened last summer. Something very unfortunate.
What happened?
Well, there was a federally funded panel of physicians in the United States who came up with, I think it was in some ways, I think it was well-intended, and I think it was a good idea to screen all patients at their annual PCP visits, primary care physician visits, for anxiety. Now, I have no problems with screening people for anxiety, but the way it's done, well, the recommendation was to use the GAD-2, which is a two-item measure. It asks, how much anxiety have you had in the last 2 weeks? And how much worry have you had in the last 2 weeks?
Well, who isn't going to answer a lot?
Well, the cutoff, who's going to say zero to any of those questions?
Right.
The cutoff was set at a zero, which means any modicum of anxiety or stress over the last 2 weeks is actually enough to flag a person today in their PCP office for clinical anxiety and treatment.
What?
Well, I mean...
And is that why we've seen all these reports that anxiety from a clinical standpoint is on the rise? Or are you saying that this is more that doctors are now over-indexing normal, healthy human emotion into a clinical anxiety setting?
It's the latter, but it's actually both. We are definitely over-diagnosing lower levels of human stress and anxiety as a pathology as opposed to something normal.
I agree with you.
Who have you met in the last 2 weeks who has had no anxiety and no worry?
Honestly, no one. And I think it's written about so much, and that's not to downplay the very real rise in,
of course,
like sadness and worry and stress that kids feel and teenagers feel and people in their 20s feel. But I do think we don't have the language, which was why I was so excited about your work, because for somebody who had anxiety that did not get addressed this way, I was afraid of it. So I drank myself into the ground. I tried to work myself through it. The second I got chronic anxiety where I would wake up panicking, I then get medicated.
Yep.
And I never addressed the underlying issues. And the medication was life-saving, but it also, I think, kept me trapped in this place where I was afraid to go off it.
Yeah. And it could have been at a certain point, you shouldn't have gone off of it. You should have stayed on it. And you
yes.
needed it in order
and
to function.
And there are plenty of times like, you know, I'm assuming, is all anxiety the same?
No. I'll tell you the way I think about it. Anxiety occurs on a scale of 0 to 10.
Mm.
But really, there's no zeros because no one has zero anxiety. And there's no 10 because that would be literally catastrophic. So we're left with 1 to 9.
Okay.
1, 2, 3 is low. 4, 5, 6 is medium. 7, 8, 9 is high. If you're at a 7 or 8 and a 9, you probably need something professional to take it down to a mid-range.
And how would you, as a doctor and an anxiety physician, therapist, how would you actually categorize a 7, 8, or a 9?
If it's getting in the way of your, at that level, it's going to be getting in the way of your life. If
meaning
you're feeling,
it's disrupting your sleep, you're avoiding doing what you need to do.
Yeah, if you can't sleep because of your anxiety, that's a dysfunctional issue. That's something that has to be addressed.
And now let's go with the kind of 4, 5, 6.
4, 5, 6. So that now depends. Some people can function actually reasonably well at a 4, 5, and a 6. 6 maybe less likely, but a 4 and a 5 for sure.
What would you be hearing typically from someone in your practice if they were saying, I'd say my worry and anxiety is about a 4, 5, or 6?
It depends on what's going on. Are they an emergency room doctor? Are they, you know, going through med school? Are they going through a breakup? Are they starting a new baby, you know? Then okay, like people have periods of time where they might ramp up and that actually might enhance their performance. It might enhance their connection.
The important thing there that I want to make sure that the person listening understands
yes.
is that what you just identified First of all, it's the step one that you taught us of identify what's the root cause. Mm. And there's a huge difference in those moments in your life where something is causing you to be on edge and you to be nervous and you to be worried and doubting yourself or scared about what's going to happen. Because that, to me, sounds like there's a situation. You know, I mentioned at the beginning of this episode that literally 2 hours before you walked in the studio, I got a text from a very close friend of mine who said, my daughter is unable to sleep, has crushing anxiety, and then added that there is this massive medical test that she needs to take for med school, which to me said, oh, well, there's this thing happening that is high stakes that explains it. But because my friend has never dealt with this with any of her kids, and because it's really scary when you see somebody who's normally seems like they have it pulled together truly start to spiral, you don't know what to do. And what I said to her is, well, I'm going to tell you something. First of all, it seems appropriate that she's nervous because she has high stakes, but I've got the world's leading expert walking in here, and this is the name of his book, and you should go buy it right now because I know I screw it up every time I see somebody, even when I know it's situational, because I get anxious for them. And so I think it's important to understand that even in your practice, and this is something you can do for yourself and you can do for somebody you care about, you identified 1 to 9, how much is this interfering? And no matter what they say in terms of the ranking, you can also say what's going on in your life.
100%.
And what's the difference between something that is situational versus something that becomes way more chronic?
Well, you know, that is important. The situational aspect is very important, but how you are sort of engaging in your anxiety. Like I said, the 4, 5, and 6, are you able to use that level of anxiety in a constructive, positive way?
If I'm sitting there with you, probably not. You know what I mean? If I'm going to a doctor and I'm like, doc, I I'm feeling very anxious, 4, 5, 6, like I'm not sleeping very well. I don't feel like anybody that even would say a 4, 5, or 6 feels like they're thriving or able to kind of use it.
I don't know. I think a lot of people might be like, hey, I'm an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
They're starting a new business. They're having a battle of a time. They're feeling stressed out, might have gained a couple pounds. And they know that they're at a 4, 5, and a 6, but they're like, but I'm going to get through this.
I can think of periods of my life like that.
Sure.
So what is a 1, 2, or 3 when somebody that you're treating says that?
So that often we see that as the goal. I'm not sure I do. I think that if, firstly, with medication, clinicians often overpromise and they say, I'm going to get your anxiety down to a 1 and it's going to stay there. I'm not sure that's even helpful.
I love what you just said. What you just said is the goal is not to get to 0.
Correct.
Well, that if we take as truth, which it is, that feeling on edge and nervous and doubting yourself, normal human emotions, the anxiety becomes a real problem from a clinical standpoint when it's interfering with your life and it is robbing you of the possibilities and the full potential that you have because you're now held hostage by the anxiety and you're scared of it.
Well put.
If the goal is that we can do simple things to identify what's making you anxious, to remind you that you have the capacity to face this, to have you share and connect with other people, and to take small steps and go, the goal isn't to go to 0. The goal is just, let's just get this to a 3. And there's some simple things I can do. Dr. Ross Marin, let's hit the pause button for just a second. Let's hear a word from our sponsors. And I want to give the person listening a chance to share this episode with somebody that they really care about, because this is a world-class resource that you're giving us that will completely change the way that somebody thinks about anxiety and starts to respond to it differently. And I love everything that you're sharing. So thank you in advance for sharing this with people that you care about. And don't go anywhere, because Dr. Ross Marin has so much more to teach you and share with you and inspire you about when we return. Stay with me. Welcome back. It's your buddy Mel Robbins. And today you and I are getting to spend time with Dr. David Ross Marin. His book is Thriving with Anxiety. Thank you for sharing this with people that you care about. Thank you for taking the time to listen to something that will improve your life. So Dr. Ross Marin, before we go into how do you actually go from the higher end down to the 1 to 3s here. I do want to stay on this topic, even though it's very self-serving, because I feel like I screwed this up, and it's the sleepover topic. You're a parent. You have a child. Mm-hmm. They are opting out, and you're very worried. It's getting into the 4s, 5s, and 6. You're not with them 8 hours a day, so you're not a part of what's happening at school. What do I do in those moments when I have a child that's really anxious? Do I force them to go to the sleepover? What do I do?
Validate, validate, validate. There's a reason why they don't want to go to the sleepover. And even if it doesn't make sense to you, it makes sense to their anxiety. You have to delve into that anxiety with them and allow them to explore it. The more you say, oh, there's no reason to be upset, the more they're just going to think that their anxiety is a problem, and they might not even be conscious of what they're afraid of.
Hmm.
But if you just ask them, like, why wouldn't you want to go to a sleepover? Not judging, just asking. What if I
wake up and I'm scared?
Yeah, that would be upsetting. What would happen if you were to wake up and...
Then I'd have to wake up Mrs. So-and-so and they'd have to come get you and it'd be really embarrassing.
I understand then why you wouldn't want to have a sleepover.
I just like my bed. I'd rather be in my bed.
Yeah. Well, that's the comfort thing. By the way, the kid just changed the topic. Now we're talking about comfort as opposed to anxiety. So I would probably double back and say, like, well, what about that Mrs. So-and-so would have to, you know, call you up and you'd have to pick me up and it'd be a whole thing. What about it? Would people be talking about it the next day? Hmm. Would it be a social thing? Are you more embarrassed about the parents thinking about you, about your friend? Hmm. Would you feel worse about yourself? And just to explore
it. There's so much there, because now I'm starting to think, like, gosh, they probably also feel self-conscious, like they can't do something that their friends can do. And that makes them seem like more. And then you might find out that their friends actually aren't that nice. I can see how there's a lot there.
And it's so individual to that person.
Wow.
But when we unpack it, we actually learn who the kid is. If you snuff out the anxiety, you'll never know what's really going on.
Is there a difference between the way that women and men or boys and girls tend to exhibit symptoms of anxiety?
So, great question. Women have about twice as much clinical anxiety as men.
Why?
They tend to be a lot harder on themselves and judge themselves for being anxious, and don't really allow themselves to experience those feelings. If a guy's feeling anxious, like, well, something's wrong, and like, there must be a reason.
Yeah.
No, you know, women are more like, something's wrong with me.
It's so true. And well, you know, there's interesting research.
Just feeds back.
It does. There's interesting research about, like, if a guy loses a job, when he gets his next job, there's no difference in the salary he makes. When a woman loses her job, she turns it back on her, becomes anxious, and starts doubting herself and her capability of handling this, and tends to take literally a 25% salary cut.
Yeah.
And so this has very, very real implications. Are there topics that you find that boys and men are more anxious about than women?
No, I think men will often snuff out the anxiety a little bit more and be a little more disconnected from it. Like, we see higher instances of substance and alcohol abuse. And that's usually, you know, often happens when people are feeling anxious and don't want to talk about it, don't want to think about it.
How do you turn anxiety, though, into an ally instead of an enemy?
Great.
So, when you're afraid of it.
Oh, it is terrifying. But therein lies the opportunity. That's what creates the opportunity for self-discovery. The reason you're freaking out about it is because it matters. So identify what's at the root of it. Share it with someone else. Embrace it when you're ready. And then the next step is letting go, which is the hardest one. But that's where it's really all about. I think all human beings would benefit from acknowledging the limits of what we can control and leaning into that and letting go. There's a difference between losing control, where it's taken away from us involuntarily, versus giving up control like you do on a roller coaster.
True.
That latter experience, when we don't have control over a situation, so if we're like, okay, it ain't my wheel.
Right.
Then the anxiety can actually be an uplifting, exhilarating experience where we lean into the fact that we aren't in control and that's okay.
And so you are letting go of the need for proof and just choosing to believe.
Correct. Correct.
And what I think you're believing, especially in those moments of anxiety, is that you're going to be okay and that you have the capability and the capacity to handle this and to face whatever comes.
Even though it's overwhelming and beyond you.
Yes.
That somehow something in your humanity will be able to rise to the challenge. Who knows how? Who knows when? Who knows where? Methods are unclear. The path is opaque, but I'm going to continue to trot along it with some sort of level of
At its deepest level, it's trusting in life. And, you know, actually, it reminds me of something that you wrote in your book that I absolutely loved, which is when anxiety strikes, we tend to get annoyed. Why doesn't the anxiety beast get out of our way? We look for distractions or a way out of the quandary. Is there a drink I can have or a recreational drug I can take to make it all go away, at least for the moment? Can I busy myself with work or by obsessively reading and posting on social media? These strategies tend to just make anxiety worse. However, if we can harness the power of anxiety, we can thrive in ways we never thought were possible. We should not sidestep anxiety or back up and deny that it is there, but rather stop and evaluate the situation. What is our anxiety trying to tell us? The answer is that we need to dig deep down into ourselves, although doing so makes us uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. We need to experience anxiety in order to transcend it. And although it may not seem to be the case at first glance, what lies inside, what our anxiety is pointing us toward, is a set of precious gifts. In this case, the gold isn't material wealth, but a deepened sense of connection with ourselves, with others, and with our spirituality. Ironically and paradoxically, we can thrive with anxiety. You're right.
Thanks.
What if you read the headlines about the melting polar ice cap and you look at the fact that there's this once in 200 year storm that happened in Florida, you know, a while ago, and you're worried about climate change and that there won't be a planet here for future generations. And that starts to cause you a lot of anxiety.
Right. Or California wildfires. Right?
Yeah. California wildfires. Like what do you do? How do you use this method
This is where the let go comes in. There is only so much that human beings can control in this world.
I don't want that answer.
You know, you're the one who says it with let them.
I know, but I don't, but I'm playing the role of somebody who is in an anxious state. And who, you know, because when you're kind of cynical when you're anxious, because you've felt this way and you're like, doc, you don't have any idea. I know you've treated tens of thousands of people and you've got a degree and you're an expert in this and you've studied it, but you don't know what it's like. Like, I just can't get out of my head.
I've faced my own anxiety like you wouldn't believe. And letting go, the truth is, coming from a spiritual and religious tradition, like I think I have an advantage here because this is the kind of message that I've been, you know, brought up with and that I, you know, attend sermons about. And human beings are not the architects of all of world events. That's just not the way it goes. We're not in charge of the weather. We're not in charge of certain things, but we're in charge of a lot. And by refocusing on that, which is within our purview and is within our control, that's using anxiety in a constructive, positive way, because that will motivate me to get up in the morning, do what I got to do, push ahead, face that adversity, have a dream and move towards it, as opposed to trying to grasp control over stuff that I don't.
I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And, you know, you're the expert, and I'm sure you'll tell us anytime you focus on or grip or worry about things that you can't control, you just create more anxiety for yourself.
I mean, I don't think you need to be an expert to know that one.
So you have so many tools in your book, Thriving with Anxiety. What are some tools that the person who's listening can put to work like right now so that anxiety enriches their relationship with themselves? Because that's a really beautiful thing that is possible to you, that this could actually create a deeper connection that you have with yourself.
For sure. I mean, off the cuff, you know, when you feel anxious, don't squelch it. Don't get rid of the symptoms. Don't try to avoid it in your mind. Actually take the time to do a mental inventory.
Okay.
That could start with a brain dump, as my wife likes to call it. Just dump all the thoughts out, you know, unravel the yarn, you know, take whatever's in your pockets and put it on the table. And then just let it sit there. That could take 10, 15 minutes.
Okay. So you just dump everything in your brain on a piece of paper, just everything that's in there.
Yep.
And then what?
And then pick out the anxiety saplings.
Okay. What does that mean?
There's going to be one or two trees, so to speak, that are, you know, that have roots and they really go down to a certain level, sometimes really deep. identify them from the other stuff. Often people come in and I ask them, what are you anxious about? And brrr, all right, 30 minutes later, it's like, okay. I think there are two or three main themes here.
Okay.
You know, you could even put it into ChatGPT and say, like, what are my two main themes?
You mean, like, do your brain dump in ChatGPT and then go, tell me what the two biggest things that I'm anxious about?
It's a language processor, right? So you could theoretically just do that.
Okay, you're going to put yourself out of a job. Okay, keep going. No, never, because we all need you.
I don't think so.
So once you've done that, you've picked out kind of the two big themes.
Yeah.
What do you do?
Dig.
Identify.
Dig.
Share.
Dig deep. Well, no,
embrace.
we're not even
No, we're not even there? Oh my God.
We're just identifying.
Okay, we're just identifying.
Just go dig. What's at the root of it? What are you really afraid will happen? If your car was parked on the seventh thing and it starts to roll, whatever it is, you know, your example
what
from
before. What is the like top five things that when you do that exercise with your patients come up over and over and over and
it's
over?
Usually one thing.
What is it?
Being alone. People are afraid of being alone, being abandoned.
Wow.
I know when I've hit that, when I'm asking a patient live, firstly, when they start to tear up and I can feel the emotion in the moment, then I know I'm getting something.
Hmm.
And often when they hit the alone elevator, like when we hit that floor on the elevator, then we're getting somewhere.
Well, it makes sense. You know, there's a doctor who's had a big impact on me, Dr. Russell Kennedy, who talks about how he believes that all anxiety is separation anxiety.
Very similar.
And it's separation from self, mostly. And your faith in yourself and your belief in yourself. And from a spiritual standpoint, if you're a very spiritual person, you also separate from the source of your belief and power because you go up in your head. And so what's interesting about that is I think you're right. If I tick through everything that I've ever been anxious about or my kids have ever struggled with, it does come down to I'm going to be alone. It's true.
That's it. That's the core, usually.
It's true. So how do you let that fear go?
You don't. You embrace it and use it to connect other people. Find ways to build your resilience with it. And then with regards to letting go, I think that's letting go of control that you can actually control it.
Okay.
But you don't let go of that fear. It's going to be there and that's okay.
So let's say the person listening or she is at a 7, 8, or 9 on the scale.
Yeah.
What is the good news that you tell that person when they walk in and begin their practice with you?
Yeah. Well, first, again, if they're at a 7, 8, or 9, that's probably interfering with their lives in a clinical way, in which case you're probably looking at a professional process.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this, whether it's the book or whether it's, you know, a workshop or whatever it is, people could probably benefit from that as well.
Right.
But I wouldn't want someone who's coming in with a 7, 8, or 9 where it's actually clinical, it's interfering with their lives, to just use a self-help approach.
Got it.
I'd probably want them to get some sort of therapy and or meds.
What would you say to the person who's listening that they've been hanging on every word, they've been either thinking about their own anxiety or somebody that they care about who's really, you know, struggling with it, but there's that little bit of skepticism, you know, that the urge to just kind of react like, well, I'm never like, I don't know that this is going to work for me, which is also more of your anxiety, right?
Yeah.
Cause now you're up in your head debating and having a negative thought about the very thing that could save you.
Yeah.
So what would you say to that person that just feels sort of discouraged or skeptical?
I don't blame you. You've been taught since birth that something's wrong with you if you're anxious. You've been taught by your parents. You've been taught that by your teachers. You've been taught that by society. You've seen medication advertisements on television. You know, for years and years and years, that message was pounded into you that something is clinically, emotionally, maybe even morally wrong with you if you this is a failing of your life if you feel anxious. So yeah, I don't blame you for, you know, having heard this for the first time for, you know, barely an hour, that it's not penetrating. Yeah, I don't blame you one bit.
Wow. I mean, you just did exactly what you told us to do.
That's how?
You validated.
Oh, I guess so.
You did.
Just popped out of me.
How has everything that you just shared with us helped you with your anxiety?
Oh my God, so many ways. You know, I didn't always talk about it. When I got my job at Harvard Medical School, it's not the kind of thing that you speak about, right? Like you're a professor and you stand up and you have your slides and you have your, you know, you have your figures and your facts and your data and you don't have your personal experience. Like, no, that would be like beneath you know, the dignity of someone within the academy. And then, like I said, over COVID, it really changed for me because aside from the fact that I was just dealing with my own anxiety, I actually saw in my data that the patients who were coming to our programs who had clinical anxiety and got treatment before March 2020 did better. Throughout the rest of the pandemic, they did not have an increase, a substantial increase in anxiety. And then I was like, hold on, I'm going about this wrong. I'm treating all anxiety like it's clinical. That's not true. David, you have anxiety too. Embrace it. I started to talk to my wife about it, have some real conversations about my fear of failure.
I've known this about you forever. You've just been hiding it together and you're annoying and you take it out on the rest of us.
She did something like, well, she actually didn't say that. She didn't even say, I told you so. She didn't have to.
What did she say?
Yeah. She did say, I know, but she held me through it and it made us closer. It created more emotional depth in our connection.
You know what's interesting about your approach is that so many people that talk about anxiety, and I know I'm certainly in this camp because I've always focused on, all right, let's get rid of this. All right, let's organize our entire lives so we don't feel this thing. So let's, you know, make sure we wake up and we do this. And all those things are very important because I certainly have identified the conditions or triggers or situations that can make me feel nervous, on edge, or anxious in an unnecessary way, like too much drinking, which then makes you wake up with anxiety. And why would you do that to yourself? Or looking at your phone first thing, which of course spikes your feelings of inferiority and puts you up in your head. So why would you do that thing? And so I think, though, in listening to you, there's a huge shift in the way that you've made me think about this because you basically are saying to all of us, and you're probably going to be like, yeah, you're right, dummy. That's exactly what I said at the very beginning. But I think you need to hear it over and over to really get what you're saying. And I finally do, which is, look, 0 to 9, just like you're always going to have sadness in your life, but it doesn't always turn into depression. Mm-hmm. You're always going to have on edgeness and nervousness and uncertainty and doubt, which is the low grade anxiety, or on the point scale, it's 1 to 3, and opening your arms to it rather than bracing for battle, knowing that it's coming and knowing that in those moments when it rises up in you or somebody else, instead of invalidating it, just go, oh, interesting, I'm nervous.
I love what you said about bracing for battle. That's exactly what we do.
Yeah.
We think of it as the enemy right away, and it's not.
In fact, it's going to be there. And so learning to, and I'm one of the big takeaways that I have from our conversation is I'm not going to call it anxiety.
What are you going to call it? What's the language
Whatever
for you?
Whatever it is. I'm going to call it nerves or excitement, or I'm going to call it I'm feeling a little unsettled, or feeling a little uncertain, or I'm a little worried that, you know, I'm not going to do well on this test, or I'm a little upset about something.
I like it. Save your anxiety.
Yeah, like I'm getting...
Save the word
like
anxiety.
Like I notice I'm like getting ready to do something, or I notice I really care about this. Like there's different ways. I notice I'm a little worried about going to the sleep. That sounds very different than I'm very anxious about, which to your original point, calling something that's vastly different the exact same thing, that's one thing that I know I'm going to do in my life and with people that I care about. Okay. And I'm also going to point out the thing that you're actually worried about. It would make sense that you feel that way. Let's talk more about it.
Yeah.
Life-changing.
Thanks.
Dr. Ross Marin, what are your parting words?
Don't judge yourself for feeling anxious. Use it. It's a human emotion. Like any other human emotion, it can be used constructively in your life.
Wow. Thank you, thank you, thank you. And I also want to thank you. Thank you for taking the time to listen to something that there's no doubt in my mind it's going to change your life. Because when you can flip the way that you think about anxiety on its head, it no longer controls you. And for far too long, I allowed anxiety to control me. I made it worse in my kids because I didn't have this four-part framework that you just learned today. And don't you deserve to have a life where you're not held hostage by your anxiety? Of course you do. And so do the people that you love. And so I just want to thank you for taking the time. And I also want to be sure to tell you, in case nobody else does today, that I love you and I believe in you and I believe in your ability to create a better life. And there's no doubt that listening to this and then taking the time to share it with somebody that you care about, it's not only going to make your life better, it's going to make their life better too. Alrighty, I'll be waiting for you. In the very next episode, I'll be there to welcome you in the moment you play. I'll see you there. No, I'm from Michigan.
No kidding.
Yeah, that's where I grew up. And then came east for college and law school, met my husband out here. Parents are still pissed. my throat is dry. Mm-hmm. Go figure. And then let them. So exciting.
It's such an honor to be here. Like I said, to meet you is super exciting. A little anxiety provoking, but in a good way.
What, like a two? Like a two?
Three and a half. Okay.
We'll take it. You did great. You didn't even show it. Oh, and one more thing. And no, this is not a blooper. This is the legal language. You know, what the lawyers write and what I need to read to you. This podcast is presented solely for educational and entertainment purposes. I'm just your friend. I am not a licensed therapist, and this podcast is not intended as a substitute for the advice of a physician, professional coach, psychotherapist, or other qualified professional. Got it? Good. I'll see you in the next episode. Stitcher.